I was talking with someone, I can't remember whether it was Chris or someone else last week, and we were just musing about what the future of ministry in the Church of England would be like, actually ministry anywhere in this country, and we were thinking of some of the situations we'd all have to face in the rest of our ministries. We'd be dealing with Christians who increasingly will be drawn from backgrounds of single-parent families. We'll be dealing increasingly with Christians who come from a background which has the lack of discipline, the lack of sense of self-worth that so often comes from long periods of unemployment. We were thinking that within the Church of England we'd be belonging to a group that's seen for many, many years dwindling congregations, is now having to face up with the economic equivalent as its resources go down and down, where recession has hit the job market for all clergy and has brought the insecurities at least to some measure in that field. And whoever was with me sort of told me that I was sounding a little bit like a sort of great Uncle Hugh, you know, rapidly getting into my old age to be talking in this way. And to cheer me up, said, at least with all this sort of dwindling size and things, we'll have got rid of nominalism. And I agreed with them. I don't know how you picture a nominalism, but I was brought up with a fairly clearly defined bit. Norman nominal, if we can call him that, would have been something like this. The Norman nominal that I was taught about and warned about would be, well, he'd probably be more religious than Christian. That would be the way we would think of him. For him, church going, if it wasn't any more a social thing, the kind of things you did just to be in with the set you were with, was certainly a cultural thing. Went to church because went to church, always had. A conversation about religious things, if it happened at all, would be restricted to safe areas. So you can talk about prayer book and liturgy and church affairs and organizations and hierarchy and morality and ethics, but you talk about those areas rather than about Christ or Jesus. Our religion for Norman Nominal was a private matter, as opposed to a personal one, and certainly not an emotional one. Something like that was the picture of the nominal Christian of my training, and one got used to spotting and identifying the type, and in the humbler moments you realized there were one or two cases that were a little bit borderline, you didn't quite know where they stood, but on the whole, I thought I could spot the family characteristic and the family likeness. So it was a bit disconcerting to read this passage this week and meet his cousin. Now let me just read it to you, verses 21 to 23. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. If I was allowed to cut one paragraph out of the New Testament, I think that would be a prime candidate. It's very, very disturbing, isn't it? I realize that the nominality that we have been talking about might be a rapidly diminishing thing, but here's a nominality that's definitely still with us, and there's no reason to suspect that this will go away. That here is first cousin to Norman Nominal. It was one of the big shocks for me to discover that this person belonged to exactly the same family. So let me just spend some minutes this morning telling you about him or her. As it is the house party season, we'll give it the usual house party headings, and we'll imagine that here's our patient, and I'll tell you about the symptoms, and then the prognosis, and then the treatment. I think that's what medics tell us they do. So let's have a look at the symptoms of this particular patient. Come and look again and see what we know about this self-professed Christian that Jesus speaks of. I want you to notice, first of all, how orthodox the person is. The person is saying, Lord, Lord. The Greek word can just be a polite phrase, like we call people sir from time to time, but in Matthew's gospel it's almost always meaning something far more than that, and here I think beyond doubt it is claiming a master-disciple relationship with Jesus. It's an emphatic profession of faith. Here's an orthodox believer. There may be much more we've got to say if we're going to be Christian, but he's undoubtedly put Jesus in the place where he belongs. There's no grounds whatsoever for thinking that this is the kind of person who will say the creed with their fingers crossed. Now, here's our orthodox believer. And notice, secondly, how fervent he is. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord. That is not the language of my pen portrait of Norman Nominal. I think in the cameo, in just the repeated words, there's a fervor, an enthusiasm, zeal. Words that make the rest of the family wince. He is more than an intellectual believer. And look how it goes on. Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles? See, it isn't just talk. There are works, too. Indeed, there's a ministry, an impressive, a spectacular ministry at that. Now, please understand what Jesus is saying. This isn't a great anti-charismatic statement. One shrewd commentator said this. He said, we might well add to this list, Lord, Lord, did we not write commentaries and exegetical notes on both books and passages of the Old Testament and the New Testament? Did we not preach many fine sermons in your name? And I'm sure we could add those things. I believe Jesus mentions these because they're the very things that the disciples were all involved in themselves. You only have to turn over the page to the beginning of chapter 10 to see that that's exactly what they were called out to do. Called his 12 disciples to him, verse 1 of chapter 10, gave them authority to drive out evil spirits and to heal every disease and sickness. They could say, Lord, Lord, didn't we drive out demons in your name? Didn't we perform many miracles in your name? Now, of course, we haven't got to the symptom yet. Just as the people speaking here have missed what was wrong, so if we just focus on verse 22, will we? That's why it's such a shock to them. They see themselves as we see them, with all the characteristics of verse 22, orthodox, fervent, remarkable ministry. And Jesus criticizes them not because the claims are false, just because they're insufficient. He has seen what he mentions at the end of verse 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. So nothing could underline more clearly, could it, the need for obedience? Jesus is taking the most extreme example he can think of to make his point. Nothing can take the place of obedience. See, I'm orthodox, can't I rely on that? No. I'm fervent, isn't that enough? No. Are you trying to tell me I can preach the right message and be outside the kingdom? That there'll be many fine preachers on that day who won't get in? Yes. That you can exorcise people and demons and still be lost? Well, Judas presumably did exorcisms. That God could give someone a powerful ministry and still not allow them into his kingdom? Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? In your name drive out demons and perform many miracles? And then I'll tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom. Only he who does the will of my Father who's in heaven. I can camouflage it with as much talk as I can muster, but it's no use. You see, these people are talking all the time, aren't they? They're saying to me, Lord, Lord, verse 21. They're saying to me, Lord, Lord, verse 22. And Jesus sees right through me. He puts me right where I belong. There is not that practical obedience to the will of God in my daily living. Well, he says, it's talk without truth. It's a profession without reality. There's no substitute for that obedience. And without it, whatever I say or do can't hide the fact that I belong with Norman Nominal. The symptom. I do not do the will of the Father. The prognosis. It's very simple and very blunt. I won't survive that day. The judgment day that Jesus speaks of in verse 22. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord. Then verse 23, I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. You see, one confession is followed by another, isn't it? Christ's confession is as public as that of the person saying, Lord, Lord. Only unlike the other, Christ's confession is the truth. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, then I will tell them plainly, Jesus says. They are the most astonishing words, by the way. I don't know if people have really focused on them and see what the claims are that are implicit in that kind of talk. Jesus sets himself up as the Lord Chief Justice of the universe, the one who will have the last word on everybody. I decide the final destiny of everyone, says Jesus, and this verdict is devastating. I never knew you. Now you can almost feel the shock, can't you? You can almost feel it. They'd claimed intimacy, and Jesus says it never existed. You know, they're almost hack nowadays, those scenes in plays and films where the husband or the partner of one kind or another, it's normally the husband who hasn't worked out what's been going on, is suddenly brought up face to the face with the fact that the relationship is all over. You know, when did you stop loving me, he says. And she, about to be the ex-wife, with a sort of frozen resentment, just in clipped tone, said, I never started. And he's left to face the fact that he's actually been living with a shell for years. Well, here there's no bitterness. Here there's no words of frozen resentment. Here there's just a plain speaking of the truth. I never had the intimacy I'd always imagined was mine with God. I never knew you. A thought had never crossed their minds, had it? They always imagined that if there was ever a spot of bother, they could just sort of say on that day, well, look, you've only got to look up the records. See what I've done. Hugh Palmer's the name. Just check it in the files. I think you must have got the wrong chap, Lord. You know, these mistakes happen, don't they? It's the trouble with computers. It's a P-A-L, that's how you spell it. P-A-L-M-E-R. Yes, I've got it. It's exactly here. Away from me, you evildoers. Literally, you workers of lawlessness. It's again a very stark judgment. It picks up those words that Dick read to us earlier from Psalm 6, and it may be worth just spending a moment going back there. Turn back, it's on page 545. Just come and remind ourselves again of the context of that psalm. You remember the psalmist writes after nights of agony. Here is the believer crying out for God to deliver him. How long, O Lord, how long? See in verse 7, my eyes grow weak with sorrow. They fail because of all my foes. Here is the righteous believer being put through all manner of suffering because of his enemies. And then this last paragraph, which as these psalms so often do, ends on a different note, a note of hope. Away from me, all you who do evil, for the Lord has heard my weeping. The Lord has heard my cry for mercy. The Lord accepts my prayer. There's a confidence that God has heard and will act. So all my enemies will be ashamed and dismayed. They'll turn back in sudden disgrace. And you see, Jesus, the end of the Sermon on the Mount, it's as if he puts himself in the psalmist's shoes. He links the authority of this messianic king, this Lord Chief Justice of the universe, with the righteous suffering of the psalmist. Now, somehow or other, those two characters are the same. And he treats, you see, those who come to him saying, Lord, Lord, as if they were his enemies. He says to them exactly what the psalmist says to his foes, away from me, all you who do evil. It is so black and white. It's the very last place, actually, we would put them. We've always got a distinguishing mark, haven't we, between those who are the real enemies of God and those who just haven't quite got it right. You don't call the Norman Nominal and his family enemies. And the cry of horror goes up if we call someone who professes the name of Christ, who calls him Lord, Lord, let alone who has a ministry like the people in these verses, an enemy of God. We'd immediately be rounded upon and told how harsh we were being and how unjust and how unchristian it was to speak like that. Well, Jesus says, not Paul, Jesus says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, and I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. See, we can't avoid it, can we? There will be professed disciples of Christ who will be rejected at the end. Many of them, according to these verses. And we've got in the habit of insisting that God has to behave in a way that he doesn't promise to behave. We insist that God must have a tolerance that he never claims for himself. There was an article in the Times about a fortnight ago, Michael Latham writing on the highly sensitive issue of how you should or whether you should evangelize the Jewish community. The Times have had a number of rather erratic articles in their religious columns recently. And in this one, he had an extraordinary paragraph in which, in one sense, he claimed to be a true Anglican and to believe the articles that Christ had atoned for his sins sufficiently, was indeed the true satisfaction for sins, and in the next sentence saw no reason why we had to tell Jews about Jesus. And he rounded off the paragraph like this. He says, is there anyone in 1992 who seriously believes that if we come across 12 Jews praying or 20 Muslims praying to God, that God is not with them? Well, I don't know what he means by God being with them, but according to these verses, you can come across 20, many, many people who will not just pray to Allah or Yahweh, but will call Jesus Lord, Lord. And far from being with them, on that final day, God will be saying, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. The symptom? I do not do the will of the Father who's in heaven. The prognosis? I will not enter the kingdom of heaven. The treatment? What are we going to do in response to discovering that there are people like that? And the question must go through our minds, mustn't it? We might be one of them. Now, I want to suggest that these verses, if none other, must call for some course of introspection. That there is a real place for introspection, for self-examination in the Christian life. I know some people make themselves ill by taking too many of these pills. They can't do anything else but look inside themselves all day and every day. But there are many others of us who don't realize how sick we are because we've never stopped to examine ourselves. I do hope this morning, if you've been listening at all, you haven't been spending the sermon doing what it's so easy to do and wondering who ought to have been listening to it. You know, of course, it's very helpful because now I realize where so-and-so has gone wrong. No, that is the paragraph before. So that's the bit about watching out for false prophets. It's a most necessary paragraph. It is still very vital and necessary today. But it is not the paragraph we're looking at. This paragraph is for me, is for you. It's for us to ask, am I standing in these shoes? Am I in this danger? Oh, it's the same theme as the paragraph about the false prophets, but it's that sting in the tail that Jesus so often adds, which means we apply it to ourselves. Now, introspection may not be a natural part of my makeup, but without it, how am I going to know if I'm one of the many who will cry, Lord, Lord, and hear those awful words on that day? For no people could have deceived themselves more thoroughly than those in this paragraph, and that's what's so frightening, isn't it? And my lovely, safe caricature of Norman Nominal is no help to me because these people have deceived themselves in such a different way. Norman is deceived because of his spiritual apathy. But these cousins, why, it's the very spectacular nature of their ministry that's caused them to deceive themselves. There's a loud profession of faith. There are supernatural experiences. Their success ratings are soaring. The Lord must be blessing them. And if I'm in that position, I still need to stop and say, have I neglected obedience? Ah, the Normans of this world so often have such limited involvement. But these cousins are so active that their very activism can lead them to deceive themselves. Has the thought never ever crossed your mind when you've been too busy to pray that the Lord understands perfectly well that you've got so much of his work to do? Martin Lloyd-Jones, in his book on this, writes this. He says, it's possible for a man to preach the gospel of Christ in an orthodox manner, to mention the name of Christ, to be right in doctrine and to be zealous in the preaching of the word, and yet really to be doing it the whole time for his own self-interest and his own glory and self-satisfaction. The only way to safeguard ourselves against that is to examine and scrutinize ourselves. It is painful and unpleasant, but it has to be done. It is the only way of safety. A man has to face himself squarely and ask, why am I doing it? What is the thing that in my heart of hearts I'm really out for? If a man does not do that, he's exposing himself to the terrible danger of self-delusion and self-deception. Those of you who will remember David Watson will know how the last year, 18 months of his life was spent fighting cancer. An illness that ravaged him, and in his book about it, Fear No Evil, which, like so much of his writing, is astonishingly frank. And indeed, in some ways, some of the muddles of the book is reflected that way, and yet there's a marvelously attractive honesty about some of his writing. He tells in the last bout of his illness, he'd been getting better and suddenly he discovered it was just a temporary remission. And he cries out one night in his bed, asking for God to draw close to him, and God revealed much to him. And one of the things he says God showed me was that all my preaching, writing and other ministry was absolutely nothing compared to my love relationship with him. In fact, my sheer busyness had squeezed out the close intimacy I'd known with him during the first few months of the year after my operation. Sheer busyness. You see, Norman may not have this danger, but for his cousins, and I suspect we're more likely to be his cousins than Norman, sheer busyness, sheer activism can blind us to our real position. Depart from me, I never knew you. For Norman, it might be negligence that leads to self-deception. For his cousins, it may just be over-professionalism. There's time for just one illustration. Forgive me if it's the one that's most likely to be close to me, but it won't be that far from you if you're going to take Bible study seriously. I've forgotten where I read it this week, but I read somewhere someone saying the preacher's greatest temptation is to regard the Bible as just a collection of texts on which to preach. So he goes to the Bible simply to look for texts and not to feed his soul. And it's shrewd, isn't it? It's horribly shrewd. Same danger the Read, Mark, Learn leader faces if he or she spends the year studying Mark's gospel for their quiet times. Same danger for the couple in the home group, the fellowship group, who study that week's passage for their own devotions. Learn all sorts of things to share with the group and to tell the group. And in the name of involvement, I never face God. Now, what's the treatment? Well, it'll need to be introspection, first of all. I must examine myself, and maybe holidays are a good time to do that. Because I must have obedience. That's the criteria for entry into the kingdom. Fruitful obedience, not my appeal to Jesus as Lord. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. I cannot afford to believe my own propaganda. See, no man enters the kingdom because of their obedience. That isn't the gospel. But no man will enter the kingdom who is not obedient. I'm saved by grace, by God's generosity and mercy. But that grace will lead to an obedient life. It must do. Indeed, it's not present in me if it hasn't led to an obedient life. And we read the whole of these last dozen verses of this sermon, because I wanted you to realize what a massive emphasis Jesus puts on obedience. Three successive paragraphs are making the same point, aren't they? The false prophets of 15 to 20, this one, the one who cries, Lord, Lord, 21 to 23, and then the two builders in 24 to 27. They've all got this point at their heart. It's as if when Jesus has finished his teaching, he knows that we'll be all too ready to listen to him, to take notes of what he said, to go and teach it to others, but not to do it. Well, I'm through, as Chappo would say, but before I shut up, let me just say this by way of finishing. The point of this paragraph, I believe, the point of what Jesus is saying here is not to leave us biting our nails, spending the next weeks wondering, am I in or am I out? I don't think that's why Jesus was speaking these words. I think he was saying them that we might be motivated to be obedient to our Father who's in heaven, to do the will of God. That if these words have sunk into my mind and my heart, I will set myself to be holy. They come at the end of three chapters in which he's been teaching the will of God, and that might be a good place to start, to go and read through these again. And notice where they don't say quite what I thought they said. And notice where I'm not living quite how they're telling me to live. And to do them. I can't afford to believe my own propaganda if I'm one of those who cries to Jesus, Lord, Lord. Many will say it. And on that day I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. William Wilberforce, the great Christian, was in the middle of one of his highly energetic campaigns to abolish the slave trade. And in the middle of one busy meeting, a woman came up to him, an old woman, and said, "Mr. Wilberforce, what about your soul?" Wilberforce said to her, "Madam, I'd almost forgotten I had a soul." Let's pray. Our Sovereign Lord, we thank you that you do not mince your words and you speak so plainly. And we pray that you would have mercy on us and you would prevent us from being those who are so active in your name that we almost forget we have a soul. Give us the grace to examine ourselves. Spare us the dreadful shock of that verdict. "I never knew you." Grant us lives that are set on being obedient to the will of our Father in heaven. For Jesus' sake. Amen.